B-Pod Studios.
You're listening to the Other Identity Podcast. To listen to the full episode, go to checkpointxp.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to The Other Identity. We have a pair of very special guests with us today, a writer-producer powerhouse duo with over 500 credits across a dozen animated series. Erica and Julie Leewald were two of the premier creative forces behind shows like Darkwing Duck, Street Fighter, and most relevant to our interests today, the legendary X-Men, the animated series. They've authored two books covering their time on that project, previously on X-Men, the making of an animated series, and coming up soon, X-Men, the art and making of the animated series, which will be out on October 20th later this year. Erica and Julia, welcome to The Other Identity.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, we're thrilled to be here.
We're thrilled.
It's an absolute, it's an honor. Robbie and I are literally tripping over each other to try to thank you guys for coming on the show. This is so big. And I got to say, Robbie, you know that earlier in the week, I told our good buddy Norris that we would be doing this interview. I know he's talked to you about it because I see that he submitted a question. He was jealous beyond belief. Uh-huh. This is huge for us. And thank you guys for coming.
I feel like nine times out of 10, when you ask someone how they got into comics or where their entry point into superheroes was, it's X-Men, the animated series.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to jump in here with that and agree because if we go back in time, to the early 1990s, with X-Men coming out officially October 31st, 92 for a sneak peek. Mm-hmm. The comic book world was there was a rabid audience, but it was not as big as people sort of remember it being.
Maybe a tenth the size of the TV audience, and it's astounding to think about now, but there really hadn't been a Marvel movie. There'd been attempts at some Marvel TV shows, but we were told by the executives, Fox executives, who really wanted the show to be successful, said, guys, you got to understand, 85% of our audience on television aren't going to know who the X-Men are, which is stunning to think about these days, but there's no internet, there's no way to get the word out. The comic book, you know, the world of comic books is a certain size. And so it made sense that if, you know, amazingly half the TVs that were on a lot of Saturday mornings were watching X-Men, the animated series, that was an introduction for an awful lot of people to the world of comic books.
So why don't we start then, you know, with the origin of the show. Exactly how did X-Men, the animated series, come to be?
Just want to, again, going way back in time, back in the early 90s, television, you only got it one way, and that was on a TV screen. Computers were just sort of entering people's homes. But if you wanted to watch a TV show, you had to watch it on TV.
ABC, NBC, CBS.
Those were the three big networks that covered the entire country, and you had your local syndication channels, depending on where you lived. Fox and Fox Kids wanted to enter that market and become a big player. They wanted to become a network, and here we are, and they are now, but they weren't back then. So a scrappy little bunch of folks trying to create an empire.
Gave opening for the X-Men. The reason that that was an opening for X-Men, believe it or not, there are people that really wanted to, believed in getting the X-Men on as an animated show. And the main one was Margaret Lesh. She worked at Hanna-Barbera, at other places where she run a lot of hit shows, but then she worked for 5 or 6 years at Marvel Productions. And early on, in the early 80s, she discovered, through Stan Lee, she discovered the X-Men comics and thought, this would be a perfect show. She started going to the networks. And back in those days, in the 80s, the way you got a show on the air was once a year, you and 20 other little production companies would go pitch ideas for story for shows to the three networks, and there was like a lady in charge of each one. In their children's division, and you know, CBS would buy 10 half hours, ABC would buy 10 half hours, and the other one would buy 10, you know, 10 half hours.
And this was specifically for Saturday morning, because that was
That was prime time. Other stuff would kind of show up in the afternoons or on weekends, but really, really the heart and soul of all the new programming was Saturday mornings for kids. And for 6 or 7 years, she would take the X-Men to the networks, and they just roll their eyes and shake their heads and say, oh no, there's not a big enough audience for that comic book stuff. Marvel stuff never works. It's too interior. It's thought bubbles. It's, you know, pimply guys in their basement with their comic
book. Oh, that's,
you know,
ridiculous.
It's not our audience of, you know, 6 to 11 year olds who we're trying to sell cereal to. So all those years she was just knocking her head against the wall, couldn't get it done. Even like kind of on the sly, borrowed $300,000 from RoboCop show in 87 and produced Pride of the X-Men as a sales tool.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
This little one-off where she got some really good artists and some really good animation and said, look how beautiful this is. And everybody just went, eh. You know, it maybe played once or twice, you know, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a Sunday. Never went anywhere. Doors are still shut. She finally gets hired as the first president of Fox Kids.
Tong.
And so she said, okay, my priorities are going to be X-Men, Batman, Spider-Man, Silver Surfer, Fantastic Four, Iron Man. You know, I'm going to prove that all these people were wrong. But even her boss looked at the X-Men and said, man, this is weird, dark stuff going on here. These are some ferocious comic books. This doesn't fit for our kids. And Margaret pushed it and said, look, I believe this could be the best animated show on television. I'll stake my job on it. And her boss really asked that, look, if this doesn't go, you know, I'm going to find somebody else for next fall.
Wow.
Ooh. And she put all her money on the line to get it on. She had an assistant. Everything fell in place. She had an assistant who's a crazed 9-year-old boy at heart named Sidney Eyewarner, who supervised all those action shows that we talked about. Every word of those shows went through his computer at one point or another. They were our bosses. And luckily, I had done a season of Beetlejuice for Sidney and Margaret early, you know, a year and a half earlier. And so when time came in February 92 to pick somebody to run X-Men, they just, I guess instinctively, I thought I was the right tool for the job. I didn't know the books. I literally, the night before, I'm supposed to pitch my vision of this world to Stan Lee and, you know, a room full of production people and people are putting money into this. I'm told I've got the job, and I said, well, that's a comic book, right?
Yeah, and there's no internet, there's no Google.
Yeah, right.
It's Sunday night, so there's no comic book stores open. You know, my friends are asleep. So I just had to nod and smile and play pretty for that first meeting. And then we jumped in and, you know, learned them all real fast.
Oh, another thing, though, there was so little confidence from other folks in the show. Eric, you were hired and I'm a writer on the show. And each of the writers, 13 episodes, they only hired all of us for one season, for 13 episodes.
The entire creative, all the artists, all the writers, all the creative production people, it was as soon as we were done with setting up the first 13, we were all let go.
Oh, and no!
Like 3 months later, the show comes on in January, and it's this immense number one hit, and they had to frantically try to get us all back, and they got most of us, but 3 or 4 of us were committed to other stuff.
But and here as a lowly writer on this, the sticks in my craw, and it's 30 years later, so hey. when you figure, hey, it was a number one hit on Fox, it made a huge impact when it came out, and it's like, oh, they're going to do a second season. Oh, yay! You know, back up the money trucks, boys. And instead,
Chaim Saban was in charge of the money for the script. Somehow it was split. A better company was in charge of money for the artists, so they did fine. But Chaim thought, well, hell, new contract. I'll pay the writers $500 less.
$500 less?
Per script. And I we just got you a number one hit. And he said, well, yes, that means that every writer in town is going to want to be on it. So you know.
Take it or walk.
Take it or walk.
That's terrible.
Somebody else.
Yeah.
But the point is, of course, everybody still wanted to write on it. We were thrilled to and grateful for the opportunity. But that was our Hollywood leverage moment after the show hit.
It's so funny to hear that story because I feel like so many TV shows that really hit have that story behind them, like what you guys are saying with Margaret, where there's that one executive who just champions the show and just kind of pushes it through on sheer force of will in a lot of ways. I feel like that happens more often than people realize.
Oh, it really does. Mm-hmm. Because nobody knows what's going to work. They really don't. If they did, they'd make $1 billion. That's a famous screenwriter, William Goldman's famous line, nobody in Hollywood knows anything.
And it's true.
And they really don't. I mean, if you could really knew it was going to be popular, because then you often can't duplicate it. Mm-hmm. Even if you find something, if the magic happens, like on this show, Julie and I worked on 40-some shows each and thought we did as good a work as we could on all of them. And yet, only once in a while do they all come together like this, and almost never like this. And it's just, you can't plan for it. It's a weird magical thing.
So, all right, you guys got the show. You know, the first season, like you said, it was a hit. You got hired back on. Can you give us a bit of a snapshot of what working on the show, you know, from day to day or week to week was like? Any moment or a story that really stands out to you that sort of defines that period of time?
A lot of it happened around our dining room table. And no plush offices for everybody. And again, situation was there was no writer's room office or anything. So yeah, Eric and your buddy, yep. Mark Edens
laid out the first two seasons. First one and then the second one when we got called for that. We were friends from college from Tennessee. And so he was the first writer I picked, and he could have been the co-showrunner on it at first, and then we asked, well, is there money in the budget for two? He said, no, you can split it. And Mark said, hell no, and I'll just get writing fees. So but he was invested from the beginning to set, you know, to most of the series seasons. He was there helping lay it out with me, and it was, as Julie said, there's in some of these things, there's a writing room where you've got network executives and you got a dozen writers, and you kind of mold, everybody throws a 2 cents worth in, and it gets rewritten and rewritten and rewritten and rewritten. That was absolutely not what happened. I mean, as I said, we have friends that write for The Simpsons, and they say they can write an episode, and there's not a word of what they wrote in the episode. Ours is completely different.
Uh-huh.
The network just looked to me and said, Eric, you and Mark, figure out what the 13 stories are, pitch them to us, pitch them to Marvel, pitch them to the production people so they know that you're not writing something way too expensive for them to produce. Get everybody's notes together, hire the writers you want to have write it, and hand out the script assignments. And then, in effect, each of the 13 is just like a writer at his desk writing a movie. And I'll check the premise that he writes up, or she writes up. I'll check the outline stage. I'll check at each draft of the script stage and shepherd it through all the, you know, the censor notes or network notes or Marvel notes saying, you know, that isn't the way Wolverine would act, whatever, and get the script through. But basically, the person whose name is on there, the only two people that wrote for that episode were that the writer and me.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. So it just becomes our movie A and our movie B and our movie C. And there's some advantages to writer's rooms. You get all sorts of inspiration. But I really loved this one-on-one business to where I was just focusing on it. You say if it was an episode Julia wrote, how can I make, you know, this Julia's best movie and just, you know, her voice and make it stay what it is. And in that way, it's an odd thing with animation on television, the kind that we do, the kind of middle budget kind, there's not enough time, there's not enough money to rethink things 11 times.
Right.
So we write it, the artists draw it as fast as they can, they toss it to the cast, they record it, you know, that morning.
In Toronto,
it gets sent overseas, everybody draws it as fast as they can, it comes back, and literally it's 95-98% of what we had on paper when we started.
And that's very gratifying. I'll just put that in there as a writer to be able to sort of claim authorship and have it be something you actually authored.
So obviously this was like you guys said, this was the number one Saturday morning hit, and you knew that it was commercially successful. But I guess the last question we want to ask before we transition into our next round of questions is, when did you get the sense that this was something, this wasn't just a hit, this was something special, this was something that was going to impact an entire generation of comic book fans?
I think
when was that evident?
Julia had that moment at Fox.
If you're old enough, there was a thing called the Fox Kids Club.
Absolutely.
One day I had reason to go into the Fox Kids Studio Network here in Los Angeles, and a gal was working as an executive there named Charlotte Fullerton, who is now her own highly successful animation writer. And I just, because we're at home, the internet's not alive yet. We're not getting updates or reports about anything.
No feedback.
So you getting any news on how's X-Men being received, And she said, well, come with me and I'll show you. So if you guys have seen those sort of milky white plastic boxes that...
With handles on them?
That the postal carriers use.
Of course.
They'll hold like 400 or 500 letters stuffed together.
So she takes me out into the hallway and there's one of those containers and it's stacked up to the ceiling and they're all full. And it goes down the hall, comes up the next wall and comes back. And every one of those containers to the ceiling side by side. And she said, every one of these is for X-Men.
Yeah.
These are kids who've written in because they love X-Men. It's like, I had never seen it quantified that way. But this is when kids had to get a stamp and an envelope. That mattered, man. That mattered.
Absolutely.
But that was like suddenly, okay, this may have touched something that I had not really appreciated until that moment.
And it's such a great story, guys. All right, we're going to come back to you in just a minute. We're going to do what we like to call the lightning round here on The Other Identity. And it's all going to be, of course, still X-Men the Animated Series related for both Eric and Julia. So stay tuned. The Other Identity, we'll be right back.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.